Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 159. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, a couple of classic films from America. The first one is Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski and starring Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston. And then we go to a classic Western from 1968, which just doesn't get enough love out there, and that's Tom Grice's Western Will Penny, starring Charlton Heston, Joan Hackett, and Donald Pleasence. Now, this movie I've got a lot of emotional connection to, so it'll be fun covering that one. Like George R.R. Martin said one time, winter is coming, so sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and I'll start talking movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Okay, so how is everybody doing? Winter is coming here. This morning was particularly cold and wet and miserable, and the cats think that I caused it, so they give you dirty looks when you let them out in the mornings and then quickly come back home because the weather is so shitty. I had my birthday a couple of days ago, which was kind of fun. I ended up with literally well over 150 people on Facebook wishing me happy birthday from all across the planet, and it just gets bigger every year, and it's amazing. It's a 48-hour period because it starts when, you know, with the world being as it is, and one day in one part of the world is not the same day in another part of the world. So basically you get a 2-day flood of people wishing you well, and to be honest with you, it's a lovely ego boost. It's truly a lovely thing to have that, and thank you to everybody who sent birthday wishes. I really appreciate them. I don't underestimate them at all. Not being a digital native, but being a digital migrant, the way people my age are, I still get blown away by the way that the internet can let people make contact, even if it's just like a happy birthday on a social media platform. I love the way that works, and I love what it does. And it does, it is a mind-blowing thing in a lot of ways. Historically, for most of my life, that kind of shit wasn't available. And it is now, and I never will underestimate the wonderfulness of it. So thank you very much for that. I did pick up a few movies. Sally's parents and her grandmother have that old school thing of sending birthday cards with money in them as a birthday thing, and I like that because it then gives me money. So I went out and bought a few DVDs. I got a Blu-ray of They Live, which was kind of cool, and I enjoyed that. I got One of the Dead, the Cuban zombie movie. I got a few other bits and pieces. I got Pretty Poison, a copy of Pretty Poison with Anthony Perkins and Tuesday Weld. And I'm looking forward to revisiting that one as well. So I picked up a few classic things. And Sal dropped a ton of money on me for my birthday as well. So what I'm getting with that is even more interesting. I'm getting a whole bunch of Criterion Edition Blu-rays from Amazon.com, which I'm so looking forward to playing and enjoying. And I'm also getting a standalone audio recorder. It's called a Zoom H2N. And what that'll let me do is take, rather than schlepping a PC and a bunch of microphones over to someone's place if I want to record a podcast, what I do is I just take the Zoom, stick it on this little tripod in the middle of the table, and everybody can then have a conversation, and I can podcast remotely. So I'm looking forward to that too. I thought I'd drop a few bucks on some quality kit in that regard, just to increase that portability and to make it more likely that I'm going to get other people onto the podcast. Having said that, I am going to be recording a podcast in June with a couple of other people in a live venue, which, yay, I love that. It's going to be at Continuum, which is the regional science fiction convention here in Melbourne. And we're going to do it for a Martian Drive-In podcast. So it's not going to be for Paleo Cinema, but it will be for Martian Drive-In. And we're going to talk about The Age of Ultron, which comes out here in Australia next week. We get it about a week before the US does because we're so fucking cool. And also there's a public holiday that weekend, so obviously they'll increase the number of bums on seats by having it released on a public holiday. So I'm looking forward to that, being the Marvel geek that I am. And then I'm going to be having a chat with Grant Watson and Sonia Marcon live for 2 hours. We've got a two-hour window at the convention where we're going to sit down live in front of an audience, in front of a studio audience, and talk about Age of Ultron and things Marvel in general. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And that'll be up on the podcast as well. So, yeah, it's going to be a cool thing. I want to try to make that an annual thing at the convention if I can. I'll talk to the organizers. They're usually looking for content the way that a lot of regional science fiction conventions do. And they need things to fill their program. And when people come along and volunteer to take up a two-hour window of their program, they're very, very lovely about that. And I want to thank them as well. And I want to thank Grant and Sonia in anticipation of that little chat that we're going to have. So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a groovy thing to do. So as usual, I'm going to go through the movies that I've been watching lately and kind of groove on them. I've been pretty productive in that regard. I've done okay. Let me just have a look. Some of them are good, some of them not so good, some of them are a bit silly, but I did watch Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Now, as we all know, I have a vulgar streak, so I watched Hot Tub Time Machine 2 with Rob Corddry and Craig Robinson and all the rest of the gang in there. Time travel, bunch of drunkards and drug takers. They actually travel into the near future where they have some really weird things. It's a little light. It's light and fluffy. It's nothing serious, of course, but I kind of enjoyed it. I don't know whether it's as good as Hot Tub Time Machine 1, but, again, it's a lot of fun. And I did sit down and have a few chuckles during that one. Now, as I said, I've got Netflix. Netflix has finally come to Australia legitimately. They still haven't got a fantastic amount of product out there, but I'm optimistic about them, and they're cheap enough that I can just afford to have them on the service if I get rid of the movie channels off Foxtel, which is, you know, they're not so good. But I did watch a couple of kind of low budget direct-to-video action flicks with a few titties in them, and they're called Cat Run and Cat Run 2. Basically, it's action stuff. A couple of geeky, dorky millennial guys open a detective agency and meet up with a high-class hooker who's also an assassin. They run in with the Russian mafia and all that kind of thing. So there are two of those movies, Cat Run 1 and Cat Run 2. And they were kind of interesting. It's kind of, it harks back for me to drive-in movie flicks of the 1970s, those kind of low-budget action films like the Ginger Trilogy with Sherry Cafaro and that kind of stuff. It's updated versions of that. Some nice locations. The first one's set in Eastern Europe. The second one's set in New Orleans. And they're not a bad way. If you just want to sit down and have a bit of a meathead movie, they're not a bad way to spend your time. And there are times when you want to do that as well. A movie that you're not going to talk at length about on a podcast or on the radio, but just go back and enjoy it. I saw another one called Hit and Run, which Dax Shepard and his Mrs. Kristen, what's her name? And I should actually have her name here. Kristen Bell, Bradley Cooper's in it. It's about a guy who's in witness protection who wants to help his girlfriend get to Los Angeles for a job. His girlfriend, played by Kristen Bell, who's married to Dax Shepard. And they end up in a whole bunch of car chases. Now, this was a kind of low-budget movie that Dax Shepard and Kristen Bell did because they have a lot of cars they own and a lot of friends in the business. And they just kind of put together this action film. Again, it was on Netflix, so I just watched it. I took a look at the list here on Letterboxd, and I couldn't remember a thing about the movie. The title's a little bit generic. Hit and Run is a generic kind of title for any kind of movie like that. But, yeah, again, it's just a way of filling time while you're doing other things. I did do a couple of documentaries, which I should recommend, one of whom's from made by a Facebook friend of mine, and the other one not. I watched Gonzo, The Life and Times of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, which is a documentary about Hunter S. Thompson. I've been reading Thompson stuff since the 1970s, really. I started out with Hell's Angels and kind of worked my way up through all of them. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, The Curse of Lono, all of that kind of stuff. So I'm a big Thompson fan. I love the whole Gonzo journalism thing. And it's a pretty good overview of his career as well. It doesn't paint him as the nicest of men, but it paints him as a complex and interesting character. So I'd heard about this documentary a few years ago, but it turned up on Netflix, so I gave it a go, and I enjoyed it. I think if you've read any Thompson at all, it's worth doing. If you haven't read any Thompson, read some Thompson, then watch the documentary. And, yeah, it's an honourable little piece there. And the man had a crazy life. The other documentary I watched, which I highly recommend, and I got the three disc set of, is The Search for Wang Wang by Andrew Leopold, who started out running a video shop in Brisbane, and he got obsessed with this Filipino action star Wang Wang, who's a primordial dwarf, is the technical term for what he is, tiny little guy. Filipino action film, crazy movies. He's playing a kind of like a one-third size 007. And this is the story of Andrew trying to find out as much as he can about Wang Wang. He travels to the Philippines. He finds the people who knew Wang Wang, his family and his friends, some of the people that he worked with in the Filipino movie industry. They go into a lot of backstory about the Filipino film industry, and it then takes a really weird turn as Andrew meets the dictator of the Philippines' wife, Imelda Marcos, and things get crazy from there. It's a story about exploitation of people. It's a story about the film industry in a developing country. It's a story of the history of the Philippines. It's a story of Andrew's quest to find out about Wang Wang. And it's a story of his family and the guy himself, and how the Filipino politics and Filipino movie making have a crazy overlap about them. It's really well laid out. The editing gives you a natural progression and a natural flow, and it has a lot of information in it, a lot of which you or I didn't know before watching the movie. And it's a good documentary. I like it a lot. I want to see what Andrew does next. I don't know where he's going next with a career as a documentarian or even with other things, but I really like this movie and I really recommend it highly. I think that you should watch it. If you're into exploitation cinema at all, it's definitely one to have a go at. Now, for the radio gig, Liz Travascus at ABC Local Radio Northern Territory suggested the movie that we talked about last week, and Jimmy Cliff, the reggae star, had been in Darwin the previous week and done a crazily good gig. He blew away all the music buffs in Darwin, of whom there are thousands. And so we decided we were going to watch The Harder They Come, the movie that Jimmy Cliff made in Jamaica in 1972, which went on to become a midnight movie classic in America and a cult classic in general. It's a story of a guy who comes down from the country into the city and he can't get a job, and he gets exploited by various groups in Jamaica, including the church, the record producers, drug dealers, and like, I think he gets involved in drug dealing and becomes an outlaw. And it's a very crude and raw movie, so there's a lot of non-professional actors in there. The sound quality isn't great. It doesn't portray Jamaica as a pretty place. It shows you kind of street-level Jamaica in a really interesting and, at times, documentary kind of way. And, oops, I just dropped something. But we really enjoyed that, too. I think I enjoyed it more than Liz did, because I love the roughness of it and the unsophistication of it. It was the first feature film made in Jamaica by Jamaicans. There have been a lot of film companies come in and make movies in Jamaica before that. Probably the most prominent of those being Dr. No. But this was the first movie by Jamaicans for Jamaicans, and with a Rastafarian viewpoint, which made it kind of interesting and made it a lot of fun for me. And I'd seen it a long, long time ago on VHS, and I didn't remember a lot of the details. But this time around, I was ready for it, and I was prepared for it, and I enjoyed it a lot, so I may revisit that in about a year's time again and just kind of watch it in a little more detail. Now, let's see what else I watch. Oh, yeah, Jean Renoir's 1954 French film, French Can Can, which starred Jean Gabin and Maria Felix. It's about the history of Can Can dancing and the creation of the Moulin Rouge. It's a very kind of fictionalized version, but it's Jean Renoir, and there are some fantastic bits in it. It ends with an enormous can-can sequence in the Moulin Rouge, which is fantastic. Forget that Baz Luhrmann shit. This is what you should go to, French can-can. It had a Criterion Edition release. I didn't get the Criterion Edition, but I had to actually scramble to find some subtitles for the version that I was able to acquire. But it's really great. Gabon is very good in it. All the character actors, Philippe Clay turns up as his sidekick. And there are musical numbers in there. There are some great cameos in there as well. Edith Piaf does a cameo playing Turn of the 20th Century musical star, for instance. She's only in it for a couple of minutes, but you got Edith fucking Piaf in a feature film. The technicolor on this is eye-poppingly good. The characters are fantastic. It has sadness, it has happiness, it has backstage drama, it has romance, it has sauciness, and it has beautiful technicolor stuff. There are some scenes in there which Francois Truffaut, when he reviewed the movie back in the 1950s, compared to the artwork of Degas, and there's a lot of stuff in there that's very Degas. There's a lot of stuff in there that's a lot like Toulouse-Lautrec's work, which is only apt because he did sketches and paintings for the Moulin Rouge, and I really enjoyed it. It's a movie I hadn't seen before, but it's joyously good, and I enjoyed it a lot, and I really recommend French Can-Can. There are a few editions out there, so if you can't afford the Criterion Edition, definitely go for one of the lesser ones. It's worth your time. The other thing I've watched is They Live, of course, revisiting the John Carpenter classic They Live, starring Roddy Piper and Keith David and Meg Foster. And yeah, it's all about Reaganomics and the Reagan era in America in the 1980s, done as a science fiction story. Pretty much everybody knows it, but revisiting it, I enjoyed it a lot. I watched the extras as well. There's a nice interview with Carpenter attached to the version that I've got, which is the Umbrella Entertainment Australian one, which I picked up again for a ridiculously low price on Blu-ray. But I did enjoy They Live, and it's kind of truer now than it was then about rich people manipulating poor people. It's all done by analogy, using aliens as an analogy for rampant capitalism. There's that really long fight sequence in there, and I enjoyed it again. It's not a movie you're going to watch tons of times. You probably need to drop a few years in between viewings, but nonetheless, it was great to watch. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to do this in reverse chronological order this time and talk about the 1974 Roman Polanski-directed movie Chinatown, starring Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston. Back soon.
Los Angeles, 1937. There are lots of guys like J.J. Gittes. They're easy to find, if you want to find them.
Mr. Gittes, have we ever met?
Well, no.
Never?
Never.
Since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Gittes. My lawyer does.
You do your job, and sometimes you find the answers to questions that should never be asked. Or you find out what happens to people who ask them.
Hold it there, kitty cat.
You're a very nosy fellow, kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows?
I dislike the word cheat.
Did you have affairs?
No, Mr. Gittes.
Did he know about it? Where were you when your husband died? You were seeing someone, too. For very long?
I don't see anyone for very long, Mr. Gittes. It's difficult for me.
Go home, Jake.
Chinatown. You get tough. You get tender. You get close to each other. Maybe you even get close to the truth. Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway in a Robert Evans production of a Roman Polanski film, Chinatown.
Okay, so we move on now to Chinatown, one of the best American films of the 1970s, without any doubt at all. The script was by Robert Towne, and the direction was by Roman Polanski, stars Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston as Noah Cross. I like this film a lot, as you can guess from the fact that I'm playing some of Jerry Goldsmith's music from the movie as I'm talking. That'll fade out in about 2 minutes. But Chinatown's one of those movies which is kind of rare in a sense, because once you know the plot, once you've seen it once and you know what happens, and you know the story particularly of Evelyn Mulray, it's a better film to watch the second, third, fourth, fifth time around. And I'll explain that a little bit later, but we probably should go into the characters and the plot first, in case somebody doesn't know what that is. Jack Nicholson, and the role was written for him by Robert Towne, plays J.J. Giddies, who is a private investigator who mostly does matrimonial work. Now, back in the dark, dim days of the 20th century, divorce was harder than it is now. Divorce was punitive in a weird sense, and somebody had to be the bad guy for a divorce to go through in most cases. And in order to do that, evidence had to be produced on proof of infidelity and things like that. There was no such thing as a no-fault divorce. It's one of the great innovations of the late 20th century in law, that no-fault divorcing. So somebody had to be set up and somebody had to be humiliated for a divorce to go through in those days. And J.J. Giddies is one of those people who gets that evidence. Now, he's a successful private investigator. He's in Los Angeles. He does a lot of work there. If people want divorces, he is the one who will get the evidence to allow the legal process to move forward. Now, this is something very important to remember, because J.J. Giddies is a divorce private eye. He does the marital stuff. He doesn't do murders. He doesn't do crimes that are really crimes. And to be honest with you, divorce work isn't about crimes. It's about morality and the perceptions. So as soon as he gets involved with a woman who comes into his office saying she's Evelyn Mulray and who wants an investigation on her husband, Hollis Mulray, who she thinks is having an affair, turns out that woman isn't Evelyn Mulray. But right from the start, Jack Nicholson's out of his depth. There's something going on here that's beyond the normal purview of his work. When he does meet the real Evelyn Mulray, played by Faye Dunaway, she threatens to sue him and then withdraws the threat because she doesn't want the secrets of her life to be revealed. And those secrets are quite dark. Now, the interesting thing about it is that she's set up as a femme fatale. This isn't really a film noir, but she is set up at the start as a femme fatale, but that's misdirection. She's the only truly honest person in this movie, as you find out as the story progresses. So, and then you've got her father, the millionaire Noah Cross, who is one of the nastiest bits of work in a 1970s American movie, played of course by John Huston, son of Walter Huston, father of Angelica Huston and Danny Huston and all those other Hustons. He's really good at this movie. That kind of courtliness and that banality of evil thing that he's got going on there is terrific. Now, Jack Nicholson was a little bit uncomfortable around John Huston during several bits of the dialogue during this movie, because he just started a relationship with John's daughter, Angelica. And one of the scenes, Noah Cross asks Jake Giddies if he's sleeping with his daughter. And apparently Nicholson was a little discomforted by that. But leaving all of that stuff aside, the ensemble cast works really well in this. And you've got to mention some of the less prominent players as well, who are very good in the film. Perry Lopez playing Lou Escobar, the detective lieutenant who's a friend of Jake Giddies. You've got Polanski in that little cameo as a man with a knife who slits the nostril of J.J. Giddies. In there, you've got James Hong playing Khan, the manservant of Evelyn Mulray and her friend as well. And you got Burt Young in there as Curly. You get other people in there, Richard Bacallian playing Loach, John Hillerman playing Rochelle Burton. It's a good ensemble, and it's got a crazily good feel for the time, too. You don't for a second think that these are 1970s human beings playing 1930s human beings. Everybody's in character, and everyone's in period beautifully in this film. Now, somebody asked me on social media, my friend Grant asked me on social media how I felt about reviewing and enjoying movies by Roman Polanski, given the subsequent events in Polanski's life, particularly the fact that he drugged and raped a 13-year-old girl on a boat not too long after this movie was made. And that's a valid question too. It brings up a whole bunch of questions that we have about celebrities who transgress. And I'm just going to digress a bit from Chinatown just to address that thing. Now, there's a really weird thing with celebrity culture, which dates back to the Polanski summit and is ongoing at the moment, where when we find out a celebrity is, if not guilty, then highly suspected of monstrous crimes, there are two ways to go with it, one of which is the, I think, more rational way, which is to say, yes, that person's transgressed, they should be punished, the law should be allowed to be the law. And then there's that other side too, that kind of celebrity kudos, the celebrity entitlement side of things, where people don't believe it. I mean, that happened with Michael Jackson. It happens to a certain extent with Bill Cosby. Hasn't really happened with Rolf Harris for some reason, but there's always those people who so like the works of a particular artist that they can't incorporate the fact that that person transgressed against the laws of society and underneath the talent and the entertainment. Maybe a person who, at the very, very least, is extremely troubled and at the very worst is monstrously bad human beings. So we have that. Now, the reason that I was a bit surprised when Grant asked me this, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate question for him to have asked, is that it hadn't occurred to me, because I see this more as a Robert Towne movie, a Jack Nicholson movie, a Faye Dunaway movie, a John Huston movie, than a Polanski movie, even though Polanski, of course, is very much a big part of the creative process. My thoughts about the movie at the time, were running along those lines that Polanski was very much a minor player in it, and that's probably psychological too. I didn't want to have to address the Polanski thing. But here's how I'm going to approach it, and it may be emotionally dishonest. I'm willing to cop to that if it is. But the Roman Polanski who made Chinatown had not at that stage committed a crime. And up until that point of his life, I have a lot of sympathy for Polanski. There's a very, very good profile of him done by Kenneth Tynan when they were writing the script for his version of Macbeth together. It's a very detailed profile on Polanski up until that time. And one of the things that becomes fairly obvious reading Kenneth Tynan's profile on him is Polanski, up until the point where he transgressed monstrously against that girl, is a tragic figure, a very talented but very tragic figure. He's the only person I know who was deeply and monstrously affected by two of the biggest monsters of the 20th century, being Adolf Hitler and Charles Manson. Nobody else has had their lives fucked by those two men to quite that extent. So I accept that Polanski, in that sense, is a tragic figure. But the moment he drugged a teenage girl and raped her, that person from that point on I have a lot more trouble with. Now, yes, it is an artificial differentiation between the two, but the Polanski who made Chinatown had not committed that kind of a crime that I know of up until that point, and that's how I'm going to approach this. And yes, it may well be splitting hairs, but I'll cop to that if it is. But to get back to the movie, as I said slightly earlier, one of the weird things about it is seeing the movie and knowing all of the plot twists make it a better movie watching it again. Now, here's where we come to the spoiler. So if you haven't seen Chinatown, you can skip ahead a bit. And I'm going to go into spoiler territory here. The fact that Evelyn Mulray is a victim of incest and had a child to her father is something that's foreshadowed all the way through Chinatown. The way she reacts at the emotional connection she has with Jake Gittes, the way that they are together, and the way that she acts throughout the movie is to protect Catherine Mulray, that child of incest, and to protect that secret and to protect her daughter, even at the cost of herself. So she's the opposite of a femme fatale in a film noir. She's, as Jake Giddy says in the sequel to Chinatown 2 Jakes, she's the leper with the most fingers. And that makes it interesting because if you look at Faye Dunaway's performance in this film, everything is there for you to see. Every nuance of emotion are true to that central secret that she has and that central horror of her life, that she was raped by her father and had a child to him. It's all there right from the start, and that makes the viewing experience tougher, but it makes it emotionally honest. And again, it shows, moving back to Jake Giddies for a moment, that he is way out of his depth. This is something that, even though he's worked Chinatown as a policeman, and as a policeman he's seen lots of things, he's not ready for what he learns about Evelyn Mulray and her life and her father. He's a naive character. His world has been divorce work. He goes in, gives the people what they need to get their divorce, and he moves on. There's no personal emotional investment in the professional life of Jake Giddies up to this point, when he meets and has an affair with and falls in love with Evelyn Mulray. This is new territory for him, and he is out of his depth as well. And he's also out of his depth socioeconomically. Even though he does run a successful detective agency, people like Noah Cross, and with their fingers deeply into the power structures of Los Angeles at the time, have an ability to get things done that he doesn't even know exists right up to a point. Noah Cross controls Los Angeles along with a number of other rich men. And Noah Cross is somebody who is a sociopath and who really doesn't not get his way in life. And suddenly his daughter's rebelled against him and she's hidden Catherine away. And he wants the only daughter he has left back. Now, there's a little bit of dialogue here between Jack Nicholson and John Huston, which kind of demonstrates this and demonstrates the fact that Jake Giddies is not a bad man, but he's a man out of his depth.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gibbs, either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future. Now, where's the girl? I want the only daughter I've got left. You found out Evelyn was lost to me a long time ago.
Who do you blame for that, her?
I don't blame myself. See, Mr. Gitz, most people never have to face the fact that at the right time and the right place, they're capable of anything.
Now, I'm not going to belabor this point beyond saying just this. There are a lot of Noah Crosses out there today. But, the movie is fantastic. As I said, Robert Towne wrote the script for $25,000 for Robert Evans, who was a producer at Paramount. He no longer ran the studio, but he was still a producer there. Originally, Robert Evans wanted his wife at the time, Arlie McGraw, to play Evelyn Mulray, but then his wife ran away with Steve McQueen. And Evans then wanted to get Jane Fonda to play Evelyn Mulray, and I don't doubt for a second that she'd do it well. I'm not sure she'd do it with quite the kind of brittle vulnerability that Faye Dunaway brings to the role, but she would have done it well. But Polanski wanted Dunaway, and so Polanski got Dunaway, and I think it's her best role, and it's one of Nicholson's best roles of the time. You've got to remember, this is 5 years after Easy Rider, and Nicholson had done a few other things. His star was very much in the ascendancy, but then along comes Jake Giddies, and he's perfect for that role. He's cocky, he's sharp, he's intelligent, but he's naive. He's working class, but upwardly aspirational. And it really is a good role. And a lot of people have very little time for the sequel to this movie. The There was originally going to be planned a trilogy of these films. First one was Chinatown, of course, as it played out. Second one was going to be The Two Jakes, which was made in 1990 with Jack Nicholson directing, based on, again, on a Robert Towne script. First one was about the water supply to Los Angeles. The second one was about the gas supply to Los Angeles. As it turns out, if you've seen The Two Jakes, you'll know that. The third one was going to be called Cloverleaf. And it was going to be about the deals done to get the freeway system put through LA. And it was going to be set in the 1950s with, again, Nicholson starring. Of course, that isn't going to happen and didn't happen. But that was the original plan that Robert Towne and Nicholson and the others had. And it would have made a really interesting movie trilogy. It would have been definitely one to treasure. But because there were troubles getting the second movie made and getting everybody together and studio hassles and Towne's script had some problems that they had to work on. And eventually, of course, Nicholson directed the film. They couldn't, of course, get Polanski back because that, by that time, Polanski had fled to Europe to avoid the rape charges. But I rewatched Two Jakes after I rewatched Chinatown. And even though it is not a perfect film, and I don't think it's as polished and adept as Chinatown was, I think it's an honest sequel to the film. You see Jake Geddes in the 1940s after the war. He's been in the Navy during the war. He's come back. He's getting fat and prosperous, still running his agency, but haunted by the events of 1937 and the death of Evelyn Mulray. And we see, in a sense, a sequel to those events, which involve Evelyn's daughter, Catherine, played by Meg Tilly in this case. If you haven't seen the two movies, see them back to back because I think it does work really well. And it does do one thing which is really, really cool in a dramatic sense. And that is it shows the after effects of the events of Chinatown on the character of Jake Geddes. And a lot of people don't like it, but I really like Two Jakes. I did it on a previous podcast. But I really like Two Jakes for a lot of reasons. Again, it's got a great period feel. It's got some good actors in it. And, I would have liked to have seen the third of the trilogy. I think that really would have worked. But Chinatown, just to wrap it all up, fantastic music by Jerry Goldsmith. It's the script by Robert Towne is one of those textbook scripts that when people are teaching screenwriting, the script for Chinatown is one of the ones they go to. It's perfectly balanced. The reveal and the unfolding of the plot happens in a very natural way. The characters are well established. And some pretty complex concepts with the water rights and the water supplies and the cons that go on and the corruption. All of that's really played out in a way where there are no expository lumps in it. It's all part of an organic flow through the script. And Robert Towne, great script writer. He started out in 1960 writing a script and starring in a movie for Roger Corman, who, of course, was also the person who started the career of Jack Nicholson. Last Woman on Earth. He did other things. He did some TV series. He did an episode of Man from U.N.C.L.E. He did some rewrites on Bonnie and Clyde in 1967. And he basically became a script doctor for a while. He did some stuff on Cisco Pike and Drive, he said, The Last Detail, The Parallax View, which is another movie that I've really got to do for the podcast. Then he did Chinatown, of course. He did work on the Paul Schrader script for The Yakuza with Robert Mitchum in it. Missouri Breaks, and these are things he did uncredited as a script doctor. He worked on Greystoke, 8 Million Ways to Die, Tough Guys Don't Dance, Tequila Sunrise, Days of Thunder, first and second Mission Impossible films. He really was a go-to script doctor for a very long time, but this is the kind of crown and glory of the guy's career. I love this script, and it's one of the best roles I've seen Nicholson in. Even though I do like him in Easy Rider, I think this is your go-to Nicholson role. And he's done excellent work after that, As Good As It Gets, all those other things that he's done since then. But Jake Geddes is the defining Nicholson role, I think. And Faye Dunaway, even though her career, she started kind of late, she became very popular in her 30s, which is kind of late for a star actress. But I think that she was very, very good in a number of roles as well. I really like her, and there is a kind of sexy vulnerability about her in a lot of roles, which I like as well. And John Huston, of course, playing Noah Cross. Huston's been great since he did the Treasure of Sierra Madre and Maltese Falcon. He was a fantastic director. As an actor, I think he had less range, but I think this one definitely suited his talents. There's never too much good to say about this film. I really do appreciate it that it's there, and it's one of those movies that I'll go back to every 3, 4, 5 years for the rest of my life and just let it happen. I won't try to overanalyze it while I'm watching it. I'll go with the story and just let it happen. So I'm going to take a break then. Then we're going to get back to another movie with which I have an emotional relationship, more so in a lot of ways than Chinatown. And that is the Tom Grice 1968 Western starring Charlton Heston and Joan Hackett, Will Penny. Downstairs!
Bigfoot! Come on in!
There were giants of the West, proud names like Shane, men of character living rugged times and moments of greatness. Now another name takes its place beside them. Will Penny, starring Charlton Heston.
You ain't seen the last of me!
Will Penny, grizzled, tough, a loner. A name deeply etched into the hard land that bred hard men like himself. Bigger inside than the violent life he endured. In the vast West, as it really was.
You ain't fighting proper!
You're the one that's down.
These times, bocious!
In the classic mold, in the tradition of the great Westerners, Will Penny takes his place now, tall and proud. His is the moving story of a lonely line rider in a world as tough as the Longhorns and the Wranglers who made it their own.
Ain't no need for you to tell us them lies.
Son... You dealt this hand. I guess you'll just have to play it out.
Hold it. All of you.
Any eyeballing done around here, I'll do it.
Will Penny, who lived a life of bitter winters, blazing summers, and vicious men.
That's him, all right.
He ain't going nowhere. We can't find him. And we just gonna take our own good time about carving him up.
Till he met a woman and a boy, both as lonely and full of longing as himself.
Don't come any near, and this thing may go off.
How many people are this shot?
Well, I guess there was a few times.
How did it feel?
Bad. Bad scared before, and bad sorry after.
You got a way of making a man feel like he's a man.
Reckon it's just a case of too soon old and too late smart.
Merry Christmas!
Yep. Will heats up slow, but when he gets there, he's hell with a hide off. Charlton Heston. Unforgettable as the character he creates joins the great ones, turning a frontier into a legend. Will Penny.
There are very few movies that I get wet in the eyes about watching. There's The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The ending of that always makes me tear up. And oddly enough, this Western does as well. The ending of this Western always chokes me up. I watched the bit at the end on YouTube at work, and I kind of had to go to the men's room. But I rewatched it then, the whole movie again, after that. And yeah, it's a good movie. It's directed by Tom Grice, who didn't do a hell of a lot of stuff. He did a couple of other movies with Heston after this, one of which is called Number One, which is about football players. He's the father of John Grice, who plays the boy in this movie. Now, John Grice you might remember mostly because he played Laszlo, the guy who lived inside the walls in the Val Kilmer comedy Real Genius. But, Tom Grice did a lot of episodic television. This movie is kind of based on an episode that he did for Sam Peckinpah's 1960 TV series, The Westerner. It was an episode called Lion Camp. It was written by Tom Grice. And this then got expanded into a movie. Now, one of the funny things is, and this is like personal name-dropping, I met Charlton Heston at a book signing very late in his life and his career, around 1997. And the first thing I thought when I saw him wasn't Moses, it wasn't Ben-Hur, it was Will Penny. When I shook his hand, he went, "Sir." And leaving aside his politics, leaving aside everything stupid we know about Charlton Heston, he's in this movie, I think, it's his best acting role. And I'm willing to go out on a limb with that. Mostly because it's the only role, really, in the career of Charlton Heston where his character shows emotional vulnerability. And that's a weird thing to say in a Western because it's not a genre known for emotional vulnerability. But in this one, it definitely does. He plays a character called Will Penny, who's an aging cowhand who's just finished a very long trail ride herding cattle. And he hires on over the winter to ride the boundary of a ranch, to keep the cattle organized so they don't drift during the winter months. And he's got to go up into a cabin right up in the hills. And he's basically got to keep things going on that frontier of the range. Prior to this, he's hung out with a couple of guys, Dutchie, played by Anthony Zerbe, and Blue, played by Lee Majors in his first movie acting role. Dutchie gets shot and Blue decides to stick around while the doctor, played by William Shallot, mends him. And they kind of separate and Will goes up to this ranch and decides he's going to be a line rider and winter over at the ranch and then decide what he wants to do afterwards. So he goes up to the line rider shack and finds a woman, Catherine, played by Joan Hackett, and her son, Horace, played by John Grice, who are basically squatting in the cabin. They've had a guy who was with them. They met earlier in a little depot, briefly met with Will and Dutch and Blue in a depot. And the man who was supposed to take them over to California, where she was supposed to meet up with her husband, deserted them at his cabin in the middle of winter, at the beginning of winter. And he's not coming back. It's pretty obvious he's not coming back. So Will tells them, "You can't stay here. You know, this is the line rider shack and I'm the line rider, and squatters are allowed to move through, but they're not allowed to squat on the property." Just as this happens, another bunch of people that Will has had an encounter with, the Quints, led by Preacher Quint, played with mania by Donald Pleasance, find him as he's doing the line riding and basically almost beat him to death. He gets stabbed in the shoulder by a knife. He gets his clothes stripped off him and water doused over him at the start of winter. And they leave him for dead. So he eventually staggers and makes his way back to the cabin and has to be nursed back to health by Catherine and her son Horace. And that enforced intimacy of, he needs to have a bath. He's being tended and nursed back to health from almost death by this woman and her son. And they start to build a relationship both between Catherine and Will, and between Will and Horace the boy. And Will's an interesting character because all the setup beforehand with the ranch hands and everything else demonstrates the social and economic realities of being basically a cowhand in the 19th century. It's a nomadic existence. You don't have any family. You don't have any roots. You're just traveling from place to place doing work. You don't know any better. These people were illiterate, and Will's illiterate. He can't read or write. And basically, they're outsiders in society in a lot of ways. The women they meet are only prostitutes or sex workers, as we now know them. I shouldn't say prostitutes. And that emotional connection and that sense of family, that sense of belonging is not a part of their life. And suddenly, in this little cabin in winter, Will discovers what he's been missing out on his whole life. The love of a woman, a sense of family, having a son, a surrogate son in Horace, and just that connectedness to the mainstream of humanity, which, he's almost 50, and which in those days and in that kind of an occupation is old. And suddenly he sees what he's been missing in his life. And that's the emotional guts of this film. I'm not going to do spoilers about the ending. He has another encounter with the Quints, which goes along pretty cool lines. And there's a nice little stunt done with a bag of sulfur, which I kind of like and which I thought was very cool. But, I first saw this movie late at night on TV. It was back when we only had the free-to-air television stations in Australia. It was a movie I watched late at night, and it had an emotional reaction on me at the end of it, in a big way. It's kind of, in a weird sense, the only film I can compare it to as a Western would be something like Ride Lonesome, the renowned Western that Randolph Scott did, and I talked about those in a previous podcast. This movie is grittily, it's as authentic as you can get at the time for a Western. They even used antique guns rather than using studio prop guns for the guns that everybody used in the film. The clothing was all distressed and knocked around with bleach and weathered and that. They wanted to show, within the studio system of 1968, what it was like to live in the West. So, you know, the money that the cowhands got, what they did with their money, what happened when one of them got injured on the range, and a lot of the setup of this film with the cowhands is showing what a dangerous and hard life it is to be a cowhand. There are two places where the results of accidents on the range are shown. One where Will finds a dead man who's fallen off his horse, and another one where a guy breaks his leg while they're herding the cattle. So the setup here is to show what a hard life this is, and just how difficult it is for somebody to move from that life to another form of life. And I like that. That authenticity is fun. Anthony Zerbe is very funny as Dutch. He gets a couple of comedy bits. Lee Majors, who'd been on a TV series called The Big Valley with Barbara Stanwyck, amongst other people, and Richard Long, is pretty good as Blue. This is years before the $6 Million Man and all that kind of stuff. So he does pretty well in this, and he backs up Heston ably in the film, so he does a nice job of it as well. You got other character actors in there, Slim Pickens playing the cook on the cattle drive as well. So you got Slim Pickens at the start of the film. You got Clifton James, the guy that plays the redneck sheriff in a couple of the Roger Moore James Bond films, is there as well in another character role. You've got William Shallard, of course, playing the doctor. You've got G.D. Spradlin, a whole bunch of familiar cowboy faces around this story, which is essentially about a man's life and the choices he makes in it. And the funny thing is that when I was watching it the most recent time, 2 days ago, I thought, what this really is like a Douglas Sirk movie for guys, in a weird way, with that emotional kind of resonance of a Douglas Sirk movie in a Western setting, which is kind of cool and kind of interesting. Now, the character of Will Penny is interesting too, because he's lived a fairly long and rough life, and he's got a certain philosophical perspective on things. And he uses his wits rather than his strength to win things. There's an altercation with another one of the cowhands when he's herding the cattle, where the guy calls him out and Will beats him up with his hat, basically slaps his hat across the guy's head and across his eyes and across his face and trips him over and doesn't fight fair at all. He kicks him, uses his feet, does what he needs to do because he knows how to use... He's a smart man, but he's an uneducated man. And time has given him a certain kind of philosophical perspective about things and a certain level of wisdom. In a limited way, he's a good man. And that's one of the things Heston said about this role that he found most interesting is this is the only character that Heston played in a movie as a starring role where his character was an unalloyed good man. Now, the other thing that this shows is that Heston had a missed opportunity in his life as an actor. He tended to play larger-than-life bombastic characters, you know, Latin-jawed heroes and people like that. But it does show, this shows more range than he's ever shown before in a movie, because it strips away that facade of the cowboy hero. It shows a real human being and a vulnerable human being underneath that. And that's kind of cool. Seeing an emotional reaction from a Charlton Heston character in a movie is very rare, and he does it very well. And the lovely thing about Tom Grice's script in this movie is there's simple words used. There's no fancy wordplay in this movie. It's the things Will says and the way he expresses himself, particularly in his relationship to Catherine, are a working man, uneducated man's word use. He's not a man who is used to talking about his emotions, and so he doesn't have a particularly developed vocabulary for speaking about emotions. They aren't something that's really part of his life. His life is going around herding cattle, hanging out with cowboys. Occasionally, when he's got some money, he'll take a bath and get drunk and get laid, and then move on to the next one of these things. And the lovely thing about the script, too, is it does, in his relationship with the boy Horace, he talks about his own childhood to Catherine and says that he was abandoned when he was about 8 or 9, the same age Horace, the character, is, and had to fend for himself and eventually drifted into being a cowboy. So in a sense, his upbringing, or lack of it, is what made him the man he became. And that's nice writing. I mean, I think that it would have been nice to see more good scripts from Tom Grice. Unfortunately, he died of a heart attack at the age of 49 on a tennis court. But I think he was one of those directors and writers who might have flourished in the more indie movie kind of thing of the 90s and that, if he had lived. He wasn't old when he died. But if he had have lived longer, I think that there would have been a couple of really nice independent movies in this man that really didn't get the opportunity to happen because of that. And this is one of my favourite westerns. It's one that I wanted to do in the podcast for a very long time. Because I have that emotional reaction to the movie, I didn't want to go to it. I think part of me believes that there's a silliness to having a deep emotional reaction to a movie. That's all it is flickering lights on a screen and voices coming out of a speaker. And there's something in my upbringing, which in its way was as tough as Will Penny's, which really kind of impedes me from engaging too often with that kind of thing. But this movie has so much going for it. The cinematography by Lucien Ballard, who did several classic westerns, is great. It was all filmed, apart from one of the town scenes, on the hills to the east of Los Angeles in California and around Inyo County. And it looks beautiful too. It's more or less the same area where the renowned westerns were filmed by Randolph Scott and Bud Bediger. Lots of hills there, lots of kind of dry sagebrush country. And it really gives a great sense of period. All of the characters are of their time. The rock gut whiskey they're selling in the various depots and towns are there. The doctor has an interesting line in the film, William Shallot, who's still alive and a jobbing actor from the 1950s onwards, kind of complains about cowboys, saying that they're just kids, they're just grown-up boys. And that's pretty much true. They really don't have the emotional complexity of people who live kind of wider lives than that. Their lives are very constrained by the kind of work they do. And as is shown in a couple of scenes too, some of them are kind of very damaged individuals and very kind of angry, stupid men. Not the main character himself, but a lot of them. And those little throwaway lines and things like that give this movie a kind of texture that a lot of westerns don't bother with. A lot of westerns are just about the gunfight. This isn't about the gunfight at all. The gunfight happens in spite of their characters and around the main thrust of the movie's plot, which is that emotional relationship and Will Penny finding the things that he never had in his life and didn't even know that he wanted in his life. And I like that. I like that fact that you can have the action stuff. And there is some great action in this movie as well. There are a couple of really nice stunts involving a wagon. There's a lot of gunplay. There's a knife thrown into Charlton Heston's chest, which is kind of cool. And all of that kind of stuff. All that's there if you want to have it. But in essence, this is a movie about human beings. And the characters are textured and Charlton Heston has never been better. He made it in the same year he made Planet of the Apes, which took his career in a totally different direction, which, even though I like the Planet of the Apes movies, I like Omega Man, I like the other things that he's done, this is an opportunity not taken. And in a book he wrote a number of years ago, Heston said that he didn't like the ending of the movie. He thought it should have had a more commercial ending. But much later in his life, but just before Alzheimer's and all the other stuff, he kind of had a turnaround on that. And he said that the movie is good as it is and that the ending is right for it, even though the movie only made $400,000 more than the cost to make. the ending of the movie is right. And I think had this movie had a more commercial ending and a more standard 1968 Hollywood ending, it would be a much, much lesser movie than it is. Now, I know a lot of my friends, particularly I talked to Morris about this, and he hasn't seen this film, so I'd be interested in finding out what you think about it when you get a chance to see it, Morris. But I think it's a great small Western. Donald Pleasence is fantastically over the top in this and truly menacing. It's got Bruce Dern playing one of his sons and Matt Clark playing another one of his sons in it as well. It's got so many familiar faces to tell a somewhat unfamiliar story. Though I do think that this movie, to a certain extent, owes a lot to those renowned westerns that Randolph Scott did with Bud Bedecker in the 50s and very early 1960s. I don't think it borrows from that. I think it's in a continuum of a certain kind of western with those films. And increasingly, as time goes on, I appreciate that complexity of emotion and that complexity of character in a western, to the usual stuff where, yeah, two-dimensional characters. I like rough edges on the characters in a Western, and too often we don't get them. We don't get the writing to the quality and the acting to the quality that it should be. And the fact that Charlton Heston's best acting is in a small Western, which only cost $1,400,000 to make in 1968, is a cool thing. So if you haven't seen Will Penny, I really highly recommend it. It is one of my favourite westerns, but it's one that I'm not going to visit too often because it makes me very sad. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. We do have two new Patreon subscribers, which is fantastic, and they are Tamora Pierce and Timothy Leiby. So thank you for that, guys. I will get the credits up for you on the next podcast. I'm going to have to re-record the end credits of the podcast, as I always do, to give the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast as credits in a movie. I really appreciate the support of everybody who supports us, and for you for listening. Not sure what I'm going to do next time. I've got a little book now with all of the potential movies. I've got some movies that I have to do for the Patreon subscribers, which I'm looking forward to doing too, because the movies they've chosen are particularly well chosen. So I'll see you guys in a week's time with another Martian Drive-In podcast, 2 weeks' time with another Paleo Cinema podcast. In the meantime, look after yourselves and enjoy your movie viewing, and I'll be back soon with more shit to talk about. Bye. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. So thank you to all of the Patreon campaign subscribers who are put a couple of bucks in and help out the podcast. First off, I'm going to go this at random. So first off, we have Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine the Scientific Advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, the second unit director, and Paul, the special makeup effects director. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. You help this out a lot, and it really is appreciated. And of course, as usual, thank you to Mr. Claude Debussy for playing the music.